Good evening. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. And my name is Dick. He'll also heal Kilowatt 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. His name is Mel. And Mel and Dick attempt to organize this and lead, organize, what's the right word here? Coordinate this very enthusiastic crew that meets in the tri-state area most Sunday evenings and discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and things related to it. With inside of a real ham radio operator is, in my opinion, a kind of a scientist. And so you'll find some of the people who sign into the TechNet have a fairly strong scientific bent. They want to find out what Mother Nature is really saying, how does why all this equipment really work, how to make it work better, how to get more enjoyment out of it. As you've heard me say many times before, there are 26 different kinds of ham radio. And ham radio by way of 2-meter FM repeaters is just one of them. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. I prefer most of the sign-ins to be the people who really do have a question or a comment. After 28 years and a month, by now we expect the fact that we understand that there probably are people listening, so that doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. Already signed in are John and Wesley, KC2WGV and N2XJN. They're conducting a rather extensive scientific experiment that's going to go on for a considerable length of time. And if you want, you can listen in on it, join, make suggestions, and so on. It's a fairly deep research within the subject of magnetics, among other things that they're looking into. And they're collecting quite a bit of hardware. You can actually hear the sounds of them collecting the hardware to do these experiments and measurements. A
repeater, timeout, cancel.
A smarter person would make sure that when he's doing a talk, he interrupts every minute and a half and gives a space for the machine to reset, which I didn't do. I think that I can hear what's going on and know when to do that. How many people run full duplex up? This is TechNet number 1,326 of the series. The numbering system is a little bit low. I didn't stop the numbering early enough. I think we're really up to something like 1,400 because this all began in September of 1982, the technical net, and it's been running essentially continuously ever since. So we have a check-ins tonight with people with call letters, name, and the yes, because they do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
N2APG, Dave, and yes.
KC2RFN, yes, Alan.
So far we've got Dave and Alan. Anyone else?
Yeah, good evening, KC1.
And WS2N, Paul with us. Brief space report. Good evening, Dick.
Yeah, I guess Paul is going to be telling us about NASA's announcement. Mel recognized Paul will be telling us about their 2 p.m. Tuesday afternoon, I think it was. They made an announcement with reference to life forms, which is kind of interesting. A little bit different than what people were expecting, but still significant information. Already, one last call. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
KC2WYE, Eric, and yes, I have a question.
Very fine, Eric. Let's see if I've got your call letters correct. Is it Whiskey, India, Echo?
That's correct.
Very fine. And, already, you're going to be a fourth on the list, so to speak. Okay, let's go over to Wesley and John and find out what's been going on. Wesley, what new equipment have you and John collected this week? And what new discoveries are on the way? N2XJN and the group, K2RIW and the TechNet.
N2XJN, thank you very much, Dick. I have sent you the email which expressed confusion that I've got trying to understand some things. The first thing that I have sent you was about the device that is a harmonica motor, and in some other description, the frequency is very low, so it's the frequency of sound that is being utilized for that. And then when I was trying to dig for that, I got Theta motor, T-H-E-T-A motor. Then I was, I had to dig further in Wikipedia, and I found Spirograph, or Spirograph, S-P-I-R-O-G-R-A-T-H. And everything was because I was trying to understand really the harmonic motion. And another one, which actually is graphically represented, is epitohoid, E-P-I-T-R-O-T-H-O-I-D, let me drop. Okay, so all of these devices and all of this theory is related to one single device that I have found on eBay, and I was thinking whether I should buy it or not. Now, one of the things that I found about the harmonic motion, or let's say you have a 13 kilograms car that is carrying two 90 kilograms football players and travels over the bumpy washboard road, and we bump space, let's say 3.1 meter apart. The driver finds that the car bounces and up and down with maximum amplitude when he drives at speed of 5.8 meter per second. The car then stops and picks up three more 90 kilograms passengers. By how much then the body starts on the suspension when these three additional passengers get in? And there is a whole explanation for that. How is that happening? I'm going to drop. Okay. Now, what I find out is that the harmonic motion and concept of harmonic motor was utilized by Honda and many other manufacturers creating a motor that is actually driving the car. So now all of this is confusing. Once we have a stepper motor and we have a turbo motor, and then we have all of this theory that is apart from that. From that, what I assumed that the device that I have sent you the link for is actually the servo motor utilizing the harmonic motion. Could you say something on it? Back to you, John. Vizek.
Okay. I'm going to be making some pronouncements. I'm not an expert in this area, so be careful. The nice thing about the technical net is a little bit like Wikipedia in that we as amateurs delve into certain things. We don't necessarily have perfect understanding of it all. We make mistakes at first, but eventually we get it straight. In fact, I saw a very nice crypto quote from Newsday this week. Mr. Hugh Walpole said something probably a whole lot of years ago, and that is, in all science, error precedes the truth, and it is better it should go first than last. If you think about what he's saying, that you make lots of mistakes. Edison made lots of mistakes, but he just hung in there and eventually found out what was really going on. You mailed me an email, let me drop, earlier in the week in which an estimation was being made as to the amount of capacitance between the ionosphere and the Earth and the amount of charge and the amount of energy that's contained there. The ionosphere sits some number of kilometers, I'm going to pick a number, like 50 kilometers above the Earth. It is a plasma, a quasi-conducting material. So you could say that the Earth plus the ionosphere constitute a spherical capacitor. Earth is the grounded lead, and the ionosphere is the ungrounded lead, so to speak. Because of weather effects and precipitation and light, clouds form, the way you get convection, all kinds of charge is put onto that ionosphere. The ionosphere is in the vicinity of 350 volts different than the Earth because of that charge deposition, because of those weather effects. Let me drop. Knowing that the ionosphere is essentially a complete conducting material, roughly 50 kilometers above the Earth, circling the Earth continuously, you can, with pretty good estimation, figure out what is the amount of capacitance between the ionosphere and the Earth. You can consider it one big spherical capacitor. And depending on which set of numbers you use, you come up with 0.25 nanofarad, 0.15 nanofarad. I went through a calculation, and within 2 to 1, I came up with the same number you did. The ionosphere, as I said, is around 350 kilovolts charged. Therefore, because of the spacing between the ionosphere and the Earth, the E field is around 100 volts per meter. Your head is about 2 meters higher than your feet. Therefore, except for the very high resistance of the air, if you had the right kind of a voltmeter, and I built one of those electrostatic voltmeters, you could easily detect the fact that the air at the altitude above the Earth near your head is close to 200 volts higher in voltage than the air that's near your feet. So there's this continuous E field, and a man named Maynard Hill from the Applied Physics Laboratory in the Maryland area built model airplanes that use that E field to do stabilization by putting a polonium source, a ionizing source, on the wingtips and comparing the voltage being picked up with a very high impedance meter. He could tell whether or not the airplane was rolling to the right or rolling to the left. By having a similar set of probes on the nose and the tail of the airplane, he could find out if the airplane was pitch down or pitch up. And he sent a number of experiments, all about 20 or so years ago, in which he had this radio control model airplane, turned on that stabilizer, and the airplane would fly straight and level very nicely under automatic control, as long as it didn't fly near a tree, and as long as the atmosphere didn't disturb by rainstorms and things like that. So this amount of energy that's in that, let me call it a 0.25 nanofarad capacitor, charged at 300... Charged at 350 kilovolts, by the usual rule of stored energy of a capacitor, 1/2 CV squared, where C is capacitance and V is voltage, and you calculate by that the number of joules, the number of watt seconds of energy that's in that atmosphere. It is my belief, and here I'm guessing, that Tesla, with his big experiment that was going on in Shoreham, in Shoreham, Long Island, he set up this very large Tesla coil. I am guessing he intended to ionize the local air, make conduction to that ionosphere in order to tap into that energy source. Lots of energy is there, and lightning is using it, or lightning is supplying it. Is it the source or the sink? We can guess on that one. But to my knowledge, except for some of the things that are taking place by way of solar wind and other space effects, the energy that's in the ionosphere is direct current energy, not necessarily AC energy. Therefore, to tap into that, I think you're tapping into a steady state direct current voltage, so to speak, and to use that into a resonance circuit, I'm having a little bit of trouble realizing how that energy transfer can take place. Let me drop. In your example of a car, where the car has a known amount of mass and a known spring constant of its suspension system, and then you add or subtract mass to the car by putting heavy football players into it, there's a fairly simple set of equations of simple harmonic motion, as it's called, where if you know the spring constant and if you know the mass, you know what is the usual resonant frequency. Very similar to hanging a spring from the ceiling and having a weight on the bottom, and you pull the weight down and let go, the weight will bob up and down. It will follow the rules of simple harmonic motion of known mass and known spring constant. As you add more football players to the car, the mass increases, the spring constant stays the same, even though you're compressing the spring a little more. Therefore, the resonant frequency at which the car will hop up and down becomes slower as you add more football players. Therefore, if you have known bump spacing on the road, and you want to run the car at the spacing, at the speed where you hit the bumps at just the right speed, in other words, you're hitting the bumps at just the the right frequency that corresponds to the resonant frequency of the automobile. When you get the phasing right and the frequency right, you can easily couple energy into a simple harmonic motion system. So you drive the car at the right speed, and the car will jump up and down with ever-increasing amplitude of its oscillation. Let me drop. This is a little bit similar to what happens when you take your child on a swing. And if you're pushing the swing at just the right period of time, you're doing it at the right frequency, in other words, and you're doing it at just the right phase angle, when the child is about to swing forward, and that's when you're pushing forward, you're doing it in frequency synchronization and at the right phase, and therefore you can continuously add energy to that system. Simple harmonic motion behaves in that manner. So whether you're coupling energy into a resonant circuit by way of pulsating magnetic field, pulsating electric field, or pushing on something that is mechanically resonant, there's a strong similarity with the way energy gets coupled. Now, let me give you one other crazy little way of looking at this. When that child is on the swing, and if you decided to push her at exactly the right frequency, but do it out of phase, when she is coming toward you, you're pushing forward, and you're doing it gently. And you do that on each individual swing back and forth. Very soon, you will be dampening the motion. In other words, the amount of swinging, the amplitude of the swinging, can be decreasing. So getting the frequency of the excitation correct is only half the problem. You want the phasing to be correct in order to really be adding energy to the system. So now when it comes to, let me drop. When it comes to attempting to couple energy out of the Earth's ionosphere, which has a huge amount of energy, you could be running a lot of houses for a lot of period of time with that energy if you can convert it into electrical energy. Because it is, in my belief, a primarily DC voltage, not an AC voltage, we'll now need some form of pulsing network that makes periodic connection between that ionosphere and your resonant network in order to get that energy out of there if you want it to be AC energy. But it doesn't necessarily have to be AC. If you take, for instance, the hydroelectric company in Canada, and a good friend of ours, VE4MA, I've all of a sudden forgotten his name, but he's a serious microwave amateur who works for that power station. They ship 1.5 million volts of DC across their high voltage distribution system, and at the other end of 1,000 miles away from their hydro station, some fancy high power electronics converts that DC voltage back into 60 cycle AC voltage using something like silicon controlled switches, silicon controlled rectifiers, running in just the right sequence. And now they generate the AC voltage that then gets locally distributed and sent to people's houses. So using energy in a DC manner has a lot of value to it, but you got to be careful how you do it, and it takes some fancy electronics to convert it back into AC. But to make a continuous connection between the DC voltage that's on that ionosphere and that AC resonant circuit to make energy transfer from one to the other, you have to have some kind of a periodic connecting if your circuit is not sucking out the energy in a DC manner. That's my first impression on the first of your two emails that you sent to me, Wesley. I may have misunderstood them a little bit, but those are some of my first impressions. And let's see now. When it comes to the various kinds of motors, when it comes to a stepper motor versus a servo motor, I told you guys about these beautiful DC, brushless DC motors being used in radio control model airplanes. They essentially are stepper motors, a high frequency version of a stepper motor with fancy electronics that can make the motor go in any direction you like, at any speed that you like. You've got complete control of the phase angle, instantaneous angle, instantaneous frequency of rotation, and whatever. Those stepper motors, which are a kind of servo motor. In the past, servo motors usually had some form of shaft encoder connected to them, which gave the feedback telling you where the motor was located in its position and how fast it's rotating and what direction it's rotating. A shaft encoder did that in the case of a servo motor in the past. But nowadays with these stepper motors, some of that electronics becomes a lot simpler, and I think that's probably the more modern way of doing it. I am guessing that some of the machines that you and John are acquiring are running on stepper motors as opposed to servo motors, but that's just a guess on my part. N2XJN, H2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, thank you very much for all of these comments. I would like to reply to the first one, first email that I have sent you. You said that we are dealing with the ADC rather than the AC. Well, I have had an interesting conversation in which we came to the conclusion that at first I have made a statement. Well, you have a capacitor, and two plates of the capacitor, one is the Earth and the other one is stratosphere, ionosphere. Now, we have a potential of 36,000 volts in between. We're sitting on it. Nothing is going to happen to us because we're sitting on one only side of the capacitor. But if we then place another plate of the capacitor in between them, the amount of charge on that plate will be depending on the size of that plate and the distance from either one of the main plates. Now, let me jump.
Yeah, let me make a couple of comments right there, if I may, Wesley. I'm going to try to keep it a little bit simple. Let me drop. We are standing on the lower plate of that capacitor. You said 35 kilovolts. I think it's around 350 kilovolts that the ionosphere is charged compared to the Earth. I think it's 350. And
yes, 350.
And if there was an even distribution of voltage between the ionosphere and the Earth, the voltage would turn out to be in the vicinity of 100 volts per meter. That's the E field magnitude. The air in the atmosphere is an extremely high impedance, continuous distributed resistor. It's got a slight impedance to it because of moisture and whatever. And so because the impedance is so high, even though the air naturally would have 200 volts more voltage at your head than your feet, because you and I as a conducting human being with water inside of us, we conduct millions of times better than the air does. Therefore, our head and our foot is never more than microvolts away from each other, even though the air around us tries to be 200 volts. So, yes, we're standing on one lead of the capacitor. However, the impedance between us and that ionosphere, 50 kilometers away, is so high that we don't sense that voltage. I think what Tesla recognized the fact that the air is an extremely high impedance. Coupling energy through that air is very difficult. Even if you had a very tall tower that got up to the ionosphere itself, and the ionosphere is a lot more conductive, still the ionosphere is a very low conductive material compared to copper wires you and I are likely to use. Let me drop. So his biggest problem would be, how do you ionize with higher ionization potential a significant amount of area local to your probe that's touching that ionosphere? If I had a tall enough tower that could reach up to the ionosphere, that in itself would be a very difficult thing to do, because it would be a structure much higher than mankind has ever built. But even that would not quite tap into that ionosphere, because that ionosphere, although it's a lot more conductive than the air between it and the ground, still it is a very tenuous thing. And without having some form of high voltage circuit or nuclear emitting circuit that creates higher amounts of ionization, therefore higher conductivity at the upper probe of your tower, in my example, without doing that, you're not going to really suck into that energy. When you listen to what happens when a lightning bolt occurs, it has a little bit of similarity here. Let me drop. A cloud gets charged with millions of volts by way of weather effect of convection and change of state. It turns out that water molecules, as they change their diameter, change the amount of charge on them. It's a dipole molecule, a water molecule. I'm talking about the aerosols that are in the air. And as they get converted from the gaseous form to the liquid form and eventually the ice form within a cloud, all kinds kinds of voltages are built up, and when those voltages get high enough, you and I see it as lightning. A lightning bolt, when it finally makes contact with the ground, and you see the great big noisy event, that tries to discharge the cloud. But even the cloud, which is a highly conductive item compared to the air below the cloud, still, with high-speed photography, you'll find out that the cloud will discharge 3, 4, 5, 6 times. In other words, what you think is a lightning bolt is really a whole bunch of consecutive flashes most of the time. That's when the cloud is negatively charged. It's a whole bunch of consecutive flashes as different portions of the cloud are being discharged. The whole cloud doesn't discharge all at once because it's not one solid, very good conductor. The bottom line of all this is to suck energy out of a cloud or to suck energy out of the ionosphere. And it's there, and there's a lot of it. It's a very serious scientific problem of how do you make contact with it, this very tenuous, very volumetric thing, whether it be cloud or ionosphere. Making contact to it is very difficult. There's the hard part of the problem, I believe. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, N2XJN. Well, we're sitting on 260,000 volts. And we see, let's say the capacitor represents 0.25 of farad. Now, we never ask the question, why do we sitting on that? Now, you and I, we both know that the electrostatic discharge could be dangerous. So another question is, why then some of them are dangerous and some of them not? And then, when you have a capacitor and you discharge the capacitor, why isn't this capacitor charging again? And the only reasonable answer for that is friction. Now, we have two sources of friction. One is the friction of the atmosphere, and the other one is the inside the Earth. And then we could say about the factors of inner core that is extended to 5,200 of kilometers and has the temperature of 4,300 of Celsius. Then we have a core which is extended to 2,900 kilometers from the inner core, and that is at the temperature of 3,700 of Celsius. And then we have a mantle. And the mantle is at the temperature 1,000 of Celsius and is extended to, and then we have a crust, which is the rocky structure that is holding all together.
Yeah, let me stop you right there. And by the way, you're challenging a living daylight out of us, Wesley. You get into quite a number of subjects simultaneously. And I know you consider the TechNet kind of important. You're trying to get in all your questions at once. And I'm trying to restrict you a little bit. Let me go back to the capacitor you just described. Assume I've got an oil-filled capacitor, good for 2,000 volts, sitting on the table, and it's 4 microfarads. I own a number of these oil-filled capacitors. You charge that capacitor to 2,000 volts. What you're really doing is you're connecting an electronic pump to the capacitor. You and I call it power supply. We call it all kinds of things, battery, whatever. What you're literally doing to charge that capacitor is you're taking electrons out of one plate and pouring them into the other. So you're creating a electrostatic difference of charge. You're pumping electrons out of one into the other. You're doing it against the current flow created by the capacitive reactant. You integrate the amount of current in amperes and the number of seconds. You know exactly how many coulombs of charge you have put into that capacitor. And by the way, the capacitor, when it's charged, the capacitor as an object always remains neutral. Because, yes, you and I call it charge. Let me drop. Because there's really an energy difference between the positive plate and the negative plate. But if I put a great big Gaussian surface and metallic surface around the hole outside of the capacitor, the amount of charge inside did not change from the time that I took an uncharged capacitor and charged it. It's still a neutral object. which is that creating an unbalance internally by pumping electrons out of one plate into the other. Then when I put a resistor across that capacitor, I can take the energy back out. Or if I put my screwdriver across there, I get a very violent event, and I take a chunk out of the screwdriver, and because of the extremely small internal resistance of an oil-filled capacitor, thousands of amperes flow through that screwdriver for a few milliseconds. And then, by leaving the screwdriver across the capacitor continuously for, let's say, 1 second, and I've got a voltmeter across the two probes, the two leads out of that capacitor, I could see that the voltage that used to be 2,000 volts has been brought down to 0 volts. Now I remove the screwdriver and walk away. And if I watch the voltmeter, I'll watch the voltmeter slowly climb back up to maybe 100, 150 volts. There's something going on funny within the dielectric material of the capacitor. When I put my screwdriver across it, I thought I discharged it. I only discharged 90-some-odd percent of that capacitor. The local oil that's around those plates don't necessarily give up all of their charge, and eventually they start coming back together, those charged oil molecules. They gather on the plate, and a little bit of charge starts returning on the capacitor, a little bit similar to what happens when a lightning bolt comes out of a cloud. Although you think you've made contact to everything that's going on inside of that oil-filled capacitor, there are little portions of that oil that you didn't touch. By the same token, when the lightning bolt comes out of that cloud, portions of that lightning bolt didn't just...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Portions of that lightning bolt didn't discharge the whole cloud, and that's part of the reason why you get 2, 3, or 4 strokes in a row if you had high-speed photography. The way some people sense it is that the lightning bolt, when you're standing far enough away, looks like it's flashing at you. Those are individual strikes as individual lightning bolts, as individual portions of that cloud are being discharged. So in order to recharge the capacitor under normal circumstances, if it wasn't an oil-filled capacitor, you'd have to connect the pump again. The pump is a battery or a power supply that takes electrons out of one plate and deposits them on the other plate, except for this crazy characteristic of an oil-filled capacitor. And by the way, there's a danger here, and this is one of the things you guys should put in the back of your mind. If you don't have a bleeder resistor or a chunk of wire wrapped around an oil-filled capacitor, even though it's been sitting on the shelf for a long period of time and you think it's safe, it might not be safe. It could give you quite a bit of grief, and I've run into that grief from time to time, this crazy recharging effect that an oil-filled capacitor has. So maybe this is a little bit close to some of the things that you were saying. I'm going to go back to you for one or two more times, Wesley. Then I'm going to move on to the other people. We're going to go over to Mel for his mailbag. We're going to go over to Paul for the space report. Then we're going to come back to these deeper items, because I can tell that you and John have a number of questions that are going to keep the TechNet and all the people who sign into it busy for a long time to come. You guys are into a very wide-ranging quest. You've got many goals. That's not bad. I'm awful glad to hear that you guys have got the enthusiasm and the curiosity. Real progress comes from curiosity. And John and Wesley and a few others, I am hearing the sound of curiosity, an extremely good thing. Not necessarily a completely throttled curiosity.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's not a completely throttled, directed, and organized curiosity, but that's perfectly all right. You take some of the really successful guys like Tesla and Edison. They jumped all over the place. They were a little bit disorganized and yet extremely successful. That guy Edison filed 1,572 patents in his lifetime, and some of them were very successful things. So you guys are going to be doing something similar. I see it coming. Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, actually, Tesla was trying to explain very similar to what you said. He was thinking or picturing the self-acting engine, and the current could escape from the thing into the whatever load was connected across the coil, or because he was dealing with the coil. Now, the movement of the current into the load would produce strong magnetic field, and that was from his patent, which then it collapses and would again produce high potential, low charge sync to couple with the Earth's electric field. My understanding is very simple, that once that device is set to the oscillation because of the capacitive coupling, we're not dealing with the AT, we're dealing with the AT. And I was trying to understand, to explain why I think we're dealing with the AT and we're dealing also with resonating factor. Velocity power is extended into the driving load when we set this theoretical device, the oscillation, because it's electrostatic oscillation system, only the small amount of the charge moves through the load per cycle. Then it is the column per second equals amps and there are loads. If the charge is used at the low rate, the energy stored into capacitive system, which is capacitor, right, will be turned into the heat at the slow rate, enabling the oscillation to continue for the long period of time. Now, my understanding is that we have a course moving, and if you put the steering stick into the middle of the the jar with the water, and you start to spin, you find out that the bit.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about it. And then with the time that that water would spin exactly the same speed as the spinning rod. Now, with the air, we have a situation in which the speed of the inner structure of the air is much higher than the speed at the edges of that, which means that the speed near by the crust. And the reason for that is that if we had such speed, that would be equal to the speed of the inner core, then actually the crust would collapse. Now, that friction creates constant charging of the capacitor. That's my theory. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this is the last turnaround at this period of time you and I are going to have right now. I'm going to go to the other people, Wesley. Without a doubt, there's a lot of evidence that the core of the Earth, which is molten and very hot, is rotating at a rate different than the Earth rotates. The Sun also does that. The center of the Sun rotates at a rate very different than the outer diameter of the Sun. It's believed to be one of the mechanisms by which some very strong cyclic magnetic fields are built up on the Sun, and it results in sunspot cycles and corona discharge and all kinds of fancy effects. In the case of the Earth, the core of the Earth is rotating at one rate. The crust of the Earth seems to be rotating at a different rate. The difference between the two, exactly what's the mechanism, is it thermal convection or nuclear or whatever, I'm not quite sure. But it is believed to be one of the causative agents of the magnetic field. So the Earth is building up a magnetic field. You and I are extremely glad that magnetic field is there, because it is a kind of magnetic shield around the Earth, which takes all of these charged particles of the solar wind, tremendous amounts of material, is boiling up that sun continuously. Let me drop.
Just one more comment. I believe that if you get to the frequency of the oscillation, which is the rotation, you are able to find actually to tune to the frequency of the most of the energy extract.
Okay, now, you believe that there is a frequency, in other words, it's a kind of an oscillation is what you're speculating, between the Earth's core rotation and the Earth's surface rotation. Those two different rotation rates. You did use words earlier that made it sound like you believe there was a voltage buildup between the two. I think there almost is not, because the Earth is extremely conductive, obvious by the fact that you and I can put down grounding rods that give you a lot of protection for your electronics. The Earth is extremely conductive, and if I put various voltage probes at various depths in the Earth, I don't think I'm going to see a great deal of voltage.
No, I said between the Earth and the stratosphere, we have a charge, and the charge is because of the movement inside the Earth and the movement of the atmosphere by itself. That's what explains the constant charge that we have of 360,000 volts.
I think I see what you're speculating here. You're speculating that the rotation of the core of the Earth is the mechanism by which the ionosphere is being charged at 350 kilovolts. I'm very skeptical of that, but I'm not positive. The Earth, to me, the surface of the Earth is a conductive shell. When I've got a conductive metallic shell, for instance, and no matter what I do inside of that metallic shell is what's called a Gaussian surface, and I can put charge on that surface, but I can't do an electronic process thoroughly independent inside of that metallic shell and change the amount of charge between the outer shell and another capacitor that looks like ionosphere. Because of the conductivity of the Earth itself acting as a conducting shell, I'm worried that is not the mechanism. Right now, when you read what is charging that ionosphere, let me drop. The best guess of the best scientists seems to be that convective effects and weather effects, lightning and also the solar wind, there are various things all taking place above the surface of the Earth that are charging the ionosphere, and whether or not the core of the Earth and its rotation, which does make a magnetic field and is doing it at a certain frequency, does that have a mechanism by which it can be charging the ionosphere? I haven't heard that one. I know that, I think that's sort of what you're saying, and that's going to require some further investigation.
What is the weather changes coming from?
Are you asking what is charging the ionosphere, or are you saying what is creating the differential rotation in the center of the Earth? But the Earth itself is so conductive that to conduct a electrostatic field from the center of the Earth to the ionosphere, I think would be very difficult.
No, I'm asking, what is the weather changes coming from? Why do we have a different weather?
Oh, boy. What causes our weather, and why is our weather changing, and why do we have global warming? Wow. Those are deep subjects, lots of causative agents, and that's not a simple one. But what's going on in the Earth's center is making a magnetic field. That's a given. But whether or not the sweeping of that magnetic field, and is it sweeping, I don't know, is that magnetic field creating a mechanism by which the ionosphere is being charged?
Yes, because then the atmosphere is held to the air because of the gravitation and magnetic field, or whatever we have over there has to somehow affect the weather. Back to you.
Okay, you're speculating then that the rotation of the core is doing things that ultimately are changing the weather. That's a hypothesis. You might be right. Finding evidence to confirm that hypothesis is going to be quite a challenge, in my opinion, Wesley. That's going to keep you busy for a while. Let me go on to Dave, who's the next person with an odd question. We're going to come back to you. I can tell you've got questions that are going to go on for years. There's no doubt in my mind. Dave, N2.
You're giving this queue too much time.
N2, APG. What would you like to ask, Dave? Go right ahead. K2LIW.
K2RIW, N2APG. How are you doing, Dick? And hello to everyone on the net. Quick question about FWR and receiving antennas and things like that. You know, let me see if I can untwist the tongue. We are always concerned with FWR, you know, when it comes to transmitting and stuff. There's so much emphasis on, you know, getting a good match on the antenna to make the transmitter happy and all that kind of stuff. Does it correlate, if we do get a nice FWR on a transmitter, and the transmitter is happy and, you know, things like that, does that thing match? Now, obviously, if I want to tune up an antenna for my receiver, I'm going to tweak it to the S meter on the receiver. So the question has to do with that. Is the the SWR always going to give us the best on the receive, or is it possible that we could have a much better receiving antenna with a lot more gain that would have a terrible SWR on transmit?
Don, good question, set of questions, Dave. And the answer is going to be a little more complicated than you and I would like if we get the whole answer. And that represents a philosophy that I'm going to give a paragraph on right now. Yes, Dick, KQRIW, the guy you're listening to right now, he is long-winded. That's a given. Part of my motivation for being long-winded, other than I like tooting my own horn, is the fact that the TechNet is primarily oriented toward newer amateur radio operators who need an awful lot of information to know how this stuff works and know how it works better. Yes, the guys who have been listening to the TechNet for a long time, or the guys who have been in ham radio for a long time, they're bored by the longer-winded questions, answers, because they've heard it all before. There is a simple solution. You go to the amateurradio.tv website, you download that information, you fast-forward to the stuff you don't want to listen to. But for no matter how long or short we make any of our explanations, Mel and I are always walking that impossible fence where we're either giving too much information and people don't want to hear it, or too little information and the new guys are being confused. We try to hit a happy medium. We don't always succeed. So that's a little bit about what's going on. But now, Vizlerm and antenna, oh boy. Let me tell you some things that are going to blow your mind, Dave. Let me drop. If I took your APG state-of-the-art 80-meter dipole that's in your backyard, in my example, 132 feet long, 40 feet in the air, held up between two trees there in Massapequa, and if I carefully tuned the transmission line and the length of the dipole and whatever, because the antenna is approximately a 70-ohm impedance, and assuming you're using 70-ohm RG11 coax cable, on the cable itself, you'll have a very low standing wave ratio. The transmitter, if it was a 70-ohm transmitter, in my example, would be very happy. The standing wave ratio meter on that transmission line would show everything hunky-dory. If now you use the right kind of instrumentation in the wire of the dipole itself, because the majority of the energy on the dipole, because it is a resonating structure, the majority of the energy on the dipole is bouncing back and forth roughly 20 times before it gets radiated. You could say, I'm being simplistic here, that in the dipole itself, the standing wave ratio is 20 to 1. So standing wave ratio by itself is not bad. Yes, when you've got a standing wave ratio, it really means a certain reflected power ratio on the transmission line. And the energy is bouncing back and forth on the transmission line, and because all reasonable transmission lines have got some loss, you're getting some extra loss because of that Vizlerm. And if your transmitter had enough tuning range to its tuning and loading controls, as we used to have in the old days, and these no-tune transmitters that we buy nowadays don't, and we fix that problem by, let me drop, we put in an antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner takes your 20 to 1 standing wave ratio of your really bad antenna, and if the antenna tuner has got enough range, it brings it down to a 50-ohm resistive load on the input terminals of the antenna tuner, and the transmitter is happy. But after the antenna tuner, the energy is still bouncing back and forth on that cable, and if the cable is not low enough in loss, like open wire line, and with open wire line, you can easily have an antenna with a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio, and the antenna runs at 95% efficiency. And it defies all of the logic that's being propagated by guys on the 20-meter band every day. You sign into the 20-meter band and you tell people you've got a 2.5-to-1 Vizlerm, and people will think that you've got very little knowledge on how to set up antennas. Why do you tolerate that? Is that bad? They think it's really bad. It isn't. By way of the curve you've got in the antenna book and the radio amateur's handbook, once you know the insertion loss of your cable, once you know the standing wave ratio of your antenna, you can easily calculate or look at that graph and find out what is the extra loss. Are you going to get an extra 2 dB of loss in your cable because it's running high Vizlerm? So with proper control so that the transmitter is happy and you're not burning up your final stage of your no-tune solid-state transmitter, high Vizlerm in itself is not bad. And a lot of us are losing sleep over that unnecessarily. I've made lots of good contacts on 20 meters with an antenna that had a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. And the guy in South America gave me a very good signal report, as long as the ionosphere is in good condition. So, standing wave ratio in itself on a transmitter is not bad. Now, when it comes to the receiver, receivers are amazingly forgiving. If I had a knob on my antenna tuner where I could turn the knob, and therefore, by way of the antenna tuner effect, I am simulating bad antennas. I can easily do that. I turn the knob on my antenna tuner, and my receiver starts seeing first a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, then a 2-to-1, then a 3-to-1, then a 10-to-1.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
An extremely interesting question will happen. What happens as I turn that knob? And I slowly turn the knob to a 20-to-1, 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. And I'm watching my receiver, I'm watching the signal strength meter, and I'm listening to the receiver. What am I going to hear? Out of the receiver, for a long period of time, all the way up to probably 100-to-1 standing wave ratio, I will hear no change of the audio coming out of the receiver. And if I was watching the S meter, and the S meter started off at 10 over S9, I'm listening to a pretty strong guy, and as I turn that knob of higher and higher standing wave ratio, the S meter starts going lower and lower. It goes down to S9, S8, S7, and so on. And because of the automatic gain control of the receiver, what comes out of the loudspeaker or out of my earphones sounds essentially the same. As you can see, a receiver is extremely forgiving on HF frequency. This is not necessarily true of VHF and UHF. Now the whole story goes on there. But in general, a receiver is extremely forgiving. Many of us have done the experiment of taking a good state-of-the-art receiver, tuning it to our favorite frequency on 80, 40, 20 meters, connecting nothing but a clip lead to the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back end of the receiver. I got a random length of wire, a clip lead on the shelf, sitting on a wooden shelf, and I turn on the receiver. The S meter doesn't deflect very much, but I'm hearing all the guys that I want to hear. They sound pretty good. That's an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna. It's very non-resonant, way long in length. I can't transmit into it. The transmitter will say, no way, Jose, I'm going to go into the self-protect mode. I'm either going to turn myself off or go down to a very low power output to protect that final state. The transmitter will automatically do that, a modern-day transmitter. So transmitters are not forgiving. Receivers are very forgiving. And what's really happening in that example? Let me drop. What you and I call standing wave ratio has got many definitions. Reflected power ratio, in other words, I could use my bird watt meter when I'm transmitting into that antenna. And by the way, the antenna gives me the exact same electrical characteristics whether I'm transmitting or receiving. That's called the law of reciprocity. So I'm transmitting into the antenna in order to test its quality. But I'm going to be using it and receiving in the next step. Don't worry about that. So while I'm transmitting, I use my bird watt meter. I measure the amount of power going forward. I measure the amount of power coming back. Assuming my bird watt meter is properly calibrated and working the right way, I go to the right kind of a chart, and I know the standing wave ratio. And once I know the standing wave ratio, let's assume it's 10-to-1. The 10-to-1, there's a lots of different ways I could get a 10-to-1. One of the ways I could get a 10-to-1 is that my 50-ohm receiver is looking into a transmission line that at this frequency, at this instant of time, looks like 5 ohms. A 5-ohm impedance on a 50-ohm system is a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. So because the antenna is acting like the transmission line of the antenna is at this instant on that frequency acting like 5 ohms, and because the receiver, if it's well designed, is 50 ohms, I've got an impedance mismatch. I've got a 10-to-1 impedance mismatch, a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. As such, the total amount of power that's conducted from the antenna system into the receiver decreases. An impedance mismatch is another way of saying the power ain't going to be completely transferred. Less than the desirable amount of power will be transferred. You can see that immediately by the fact that the S meter on the receiver goes down lower than it would with a 50 ohm antenna. So less power is being absorbed by the receiver, but because the amount of noise in the background on HF frequency is so high, usually the noise is equivalent to a 30 decibel noise figure or more. It's an approximate amount.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's an approximate amount of noise that you and I could reflect to a resistor that's hot making noise. It might be at 30,000 degrees centigrade. It doesn't matter. There's an amount of noise coming in the atmosphere because of thunderstorms going around that ionosphere that Wesley and other people are studying. There's zillions of thunderstorms going around the Earth all the time. That's one of the sources of noise. There's a whole lot of noise in the background, a whole lot of signal in the background you and I want to listen to, because there's a lot of guys out there with kilowatt transmitters. So when I'm using that random length of wire, or when I'm using your 5-ohm antenna with a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio,
In either case, I'm getting a smaller amount of energy coupled from the antenna into that receiver. I'm getting maybe the number is a 5-to-1 difference, a 5-to-1 decrease in the amount of noise, and a 5-to-1 decrease in the amount of signal. And therefore I get a S8 instead of an S9 out of the receiver. But the automatic gain control takes over, and what comes out of the loudspeaker sounds the same. So you see some of the mechanism of why the receiver is extremely forgiving. It's not going to explode. You can take the world's worst, highest or lowest standing wave ratio of any antenna, as long as it doesn't have a static charge on it. Connect it to your receiver, it's not going to do any damage. You may not get as much S-meter deflection as you like, but as you can see, a receiver is very forgiving. Standing wave ratio really represents an impedance mismatch, which means the amount of energy transferred is not as high as it could be. That's a lot more important on the transmitter. You can get away with murder on the receiver. You've now got about half of the story, Dave, but I wonder if so far what you've heard makes some sense. And if not, ask some more questions. N2APG, K2RIW on the DECNAT.
This is N2APG. That sounded like Morse code. Yeah, very good, Dick. I was just kind of, curious about that. And also, I don't think, well, there probably is a device. The second question is, we have SWR meters that we use for our transmitters. Is there also some sort of an accessory meter that we would use for our receivers? Not the S meter on the radio, but some other device. And I'm sure that there's probably a Hewlett Packard something or other that has all sorts of stuff, that could be used for that. But I don't think there's anything that I remember that's geared towards the amateur consumer. Very good on that. Change the topic real quick, and I'll let you go on to the next person. I sent you a couple of emails on the Bullmark missile systems. Wonder if you got those. And I was, let me just drop it.
I sure did, Dave. Both Bullmark and Nike, and you're sending me some beautiful pictures of these systems and what is left over to them. By the way, that instrumentation that you connect to your antenna that'll make a measurement for you is called Network Analyzer. That's one of the things that'll do it. But I'm going to let you in on a secret. Whether it's called Network Analyzer and you paid $30,000 for it, whether it's called Berg Wattmeter and you paid a hell of a lot less for it, or whether it's an MFJ standing wave ratio / impedance meter, they all have something in common. You can't test an antenna without sending a signal through it. Now, from the shack, the only way you can easily send a signal through the system is to transmit through it. Your transmitter, through the Berg wattmeter, sends up a signal and measures how much comes back, and with a little bit of a measurement and the calculation, you know the standing wave ratio. That $30,000 Hewlett Packard 8520 network analyzer does the same thing. He's transmitting a milliwatt signal up the antenna and measuring the amplitude and the phase angle of what comes back, and he's displaying it on your Smith chart, if that's the chart, if that's the method of display you've chosen on the screen. It transmits. There's one slight exception to that. If I had control of the other end of the transmission line, if I could take a known amount of signal and send it down the antenna, and then in the shack, I've got some kind of not too complicated electronics that sweeps the resistive component and sweeps the reactive component of the receiving device and finds out what resistor number and what capacitor number, so to speak, or what inductor number, makes the S meter go the highest. Therefore, I'm finding the impedance that will match the antenna, transmission line impedance, in this circumstance. Therefore, I find out what impedance gives
repeater,
I'm finding out what impedance gives me the most efficient energy transfer. So, the only way you really measure impedance is to really put a signal through it. And think about it. DC-wise, you and I do the exact same thing when we use an ohmmeter. When I use an ohmmeter, there's a battery inside that ohmmeter, the triplet model 630 or your Simpson 260, whatever. That battery puts a known impedance, the
battery goes through a known resistor inside of the voltohm-milliammeter. It puts a, it tries to put a known amount of voltage or current through your resistor.